The message you are about to hear is brought to you by Art Bredick. And now, Art Bredick.
Some say that money is the root of all evil. But I don't say that. I believe there's another root, and that root is far worse. And it's this. It's a drive that's in each one of us that is so powerful it almost always leads to sin. And this drive is in each living organism, actually. It's in snails. It's in mollusks. It's in every living thing, from lowest to highest. And they even say that single-cell organisms have this drive. Now, the drive I'm talking about is this. It's self-preservation. The preservation of our lives, the force, the drive within us to defend ourselves and to save our flesh. Now, God designed this to be a part of each one of us, a part of our programming internally, and it's something that can actually take over and override all our thoughts and actions, and it'll occur whenever we're threatened by some kind of danger. As children, we have this mechanism, and it protects us, from so many things, from unbearable circumstances that sometimes we experience as children. And it helps us deal with trauma in our lives as we grow up. This is the defense mechanism. And the scientists tell us that it's located somewhere between the frontal lobes, between the two temples. And when we're threatened, under any circumstance, this is triggered. And it happens automatically. And when it does, it will energize the entire body's emotional system. The adrenal glands, they begin to secrete, the capillaries begin to expand, the muscle tissues all change, the blood flow is cut off to the stomach, and each one of us, when this occurs, is automatically prepared to flee or to fight. We'll automatically do anything, practically, to save ourselves, and we don't have to think about it, and that's why we automatically will pull our hand out of the fire. The nervous system, it'll operate automatically to do everything it has to do to save the body, to save itself. And we'll override almost all other forces to protect ourselves. And sometimes it'll even give us superhuman strength. It's an awesome force in the human mind. And I still remember watching a video years ago of a woman who's experienced the car fell on her son who was working on it, was jacked up. The car fell on her son, and she panicked and ran over without thinking and actually lifted the back of the car up to free her son. It's such a powerful, powerful force in us. Now, the problem lies in this. If only acted on by human nature, this force can get out of control. It can become extremely destructive to not only ourselves, but to others. Uncontrolled, it almost always will lead to sin. And it reduces you and I, when it occurs, to our lowest common denominator. And when Darwin studied this, he found out its existence. He actually called it survival of the fittest. And this drive to survive is so powerful. It is one of the most powerful drives that we have. And again, I say it operates automatically. And unchained, unbridled in a man or woman, it can cause us to act uncontrollably. And uncontrolled and misdirected, it can be extremely destructive. Now, there's a story that I think illustrates the power of the defense mechanism. It's a story about a Jewish man who had to serve at a Nazi concentration camp, and he worked in the crematorium in Treblinka. And he was asked what it was that he felt was the hardest thing for him to endure during the camp. And he said it wasn't the hard work. It wasn't the starvation. He says it was this. When the doors to the death chamber were open, what he saw, because it was his job to go in and clean out the bodies, what he saw sickened and shocked him every time. Because he explained the cyanide gas that they used was heavier than air and it would rise from the floor. And the higher one could get, the longer an individual could postpone death. And the turning on of the gas unleashed a desperate struggle. And inside, there would be 3,000 sometimes closely packed men and women and children there. And suddenly, when the gas was unleashed, they would all fight to rise to the top. When it was all over and the doors were open, then he would see it every time. On the bottom would be the weak and the aged. Then there were the children and the women next. And then the strongest of the men would be on the top. And he said those on the bottom sometimes had their bodies and face crushed. They were bloodied beyond recognition, he would say. And in the panic of death that was brought on by the Nazi death machine, a man in the darkness might push to the top over the shattered skull of his own son or daughter. This may sound like a horrible example, a horrible thing to happen, but I give the example because it's so real and it demonstrates how powerful this drive is. The defense mechanism can sometimes drive us to do almost anything, and we will sometimes automatically hurt others in order to save ourselves. The defense mechanism will even blind us to what it is that we're doing. And we'll do just about anything to save our flesh. And uncontrolled, it can drive us to do horrible things, all in the name of saving ourselves. Now, this defense mechanism is what Jesus Christ overcame in order to lay down his life for us. And we all have this drive, and Jesus Christ, when he was human on the earth, he had human nature, and he had this same drive in him. And he was tempted, as it says, in every way that we are. And so it says in Hebrews 4 and verse 15, "For we have not a high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but he was in all points tempted like we are, yet he was without sin." Let's go to Matthew 26 for another scripture. Matthew 26. Jesus was tempted in this way, and we're all tempted too, to save ourselves. Many times we will unwittingly hurt others, though, in our attempt to save ourselves. And Jesus had to confront this most powerful of all drives, and he felt the full pull on him to flee or fight. Yes, I believe every single cell and every fiber of his being cried out to live. His entire being cried out, run. In Matthew 26, verse 36, it says, "Then came Jesus with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said unto his disciples, Sit here a while I go yonder and pray. And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, and began to be sorrowful and very heavy. And then he said unto them, My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even unto death. Tarry you here and watch with me. And he went a little further and fell on his face, and he prayed, saying, O Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. And then he answered himself, saying, Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." Here was Jesus in seemingly terrible agony. I believe he was being torn apart emotionally and psychologically as this occurred. He knew what was going to happen to him. Jesus had lived and grown up in that territory that was occupied by the Romans, and he saw the soldiers' brutality as he grew up, and he had witnessed crucifixion himself because they would crucify the people outside by the roads so that anyone coming in or going out would see this kind of brutality, and they would rule these people in fear and frighten them into submission. So he knew well what was coming. He knew and could visualize the lictor's brutal whip tearing apart his flesh, and he could imagine the spikes being driven into his hands. And he knew the degrading humiliation of all that was going to occur. And so he told the disciples, pray that they didn't enter into temptation. He knew this kind of thing would be a terrible temptation. And I believe that the disciples, and he knew the disciples, didn't really know what was going to happen. But he was reflecting what was in his mind, this was a temptation, and he was tempted like we are, and he knew what was in this, and he was praying that he not be so tempted to save himself and not fight back. And it says he was praying so fervently that he actually sweat blood. Now, I almost saw this happen once, and I remember when my first child was being born, my son, David, the first son, and I watched my wife as she was pushing to push him out. And I had never seen anyone work so hard, and I never felt so totally incompetent and unable to do anything about the circumstances I did then. But I remember she was working so hard, she was perspiring profusely, and I remember she pushed and strained so hard that she actually forced the capillaries out to the surface of her skin, and there they would form little dots of blood blisters all over her forehead and her face, and they didn't break, but if they would have broken, she would have actually sweat blood. But it was then that I saw the kind of stress, the kind of strain, and the intensity with which Jesus Christ was praying. He was praying and struggling to control this human nature, to overcome this powerful force called the defense mechanism. And he was in full control. He didn't flee, and he didn't fight. He took and made this effort to overcome this drive, and it is a monumental effort to do so on his part. Notice what he said in his temptation in verse 41. He said this, "Watch and pray that you enter not into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." And so his flesh was experiencing the same thing that our flesh does, that when we're threatened, we go into a defense mode, and the most basic, strongest force in a human being takes over. And Jesus chose to submit his life to God's will, and he did so even though he knew it was going to hurt. And this is something I believe all of us must be able to come to do, to rule over this deep and powerful drive that's in the flesh. Now, the reason to me that this is so important to all of us is this. The defense mechanism is there in each one of us, and it's operating all the time. It's operating at different levels and to different degrees. And because of that, the threat does not have to be all that great for us to react. Sometimes it only requires a threat or the smallest of losses, and we'll act to defend ourselves. And in so doing, we can injure others. There's a story about a samurai warrior. And this great warrior's servant was one day helping him to dress. And as he was dressing him, the servant noticed a flea on the back of his master's back. And realizing this, he flicked the flea from off of the great warrior's back. And immediately the samurai knew what he had done. And he grabbed his sword, wheeled around, and sliced his servant in half. Now, the reason he did this was because in his mind, fleas were a problem to beasts of the field, not to a samurai warrior. He took the flicking of the flea, as small as that little act was, as a grave insult. And he rewarded his servant with the punishment he believed that he did deserve. He retaliated with what he thought was a just punishment. You see, this is the point. It doesn't have to be that our lives are threatened for us to retaliate. You know, all we need is for something we value to be threatened, or some sort of small loss. It can be as little a thing as our ego being damaged, and we will react. And then here's what happens. The defense mechanism can blind us to seeing that we're doing anything wrong. We don't think of ourselves as doing evil. We'll rationalize it. And so we can do evil and think we're doing good. And this is why this thing is so dangerous. Sometimes it requires only the threat of something so small as something we care about to send us to war with others. King Ashurbanipal was the grandson of Sennacherib. And some of his subjects had been angry at his god, and they cursed his god. And he turned on them with a very powerful response from his defense mechanism. Here's what he actually had written from Religious Mythology in The Art of War on page 177. Here's what Ashurbanipal said. Because they uttered curses against Ashur, my god, and devised evil against me, his worshiper, King Ashurbanipal, I delivered them to the wrath of God. Their tongues I pulled out, I cut off their heads, I burned them with fire, a pile of living men and heads against the city gate. I set up men and I impaled them on stakes. The city I destroyed and I devastated. I turned it into mounds and ruinous heaps. By these things which were done, declared the king, I satisfied the hearts of the great gods. Let's go to John 16. John 16. See, Ashurbanipal's story is one of extreme response. It's excessive force. But the story is not uncommon, because all of us have this tendency to retaliate when something of ours is threatened. And in Ashurbanipal's mind, he was doing good. And I say again, his story isn't unique. It's the same story throughout all of human history, and especially religious history. A path of blood from the beginning of time until now. Always the result of somebody thinking they're doing good. John 16, verse 2, here's what Christ said. They'll put you out of the synagogues. Yes, the time comes that whoever kills you will think that they do God a service. Think about that. There's a time coming where they'll kill you and think they're doing a service to God. See, we're capable of doing the most horrendous evil and thinking we're doing it for the most wonderful good, the best cause. And so it's imperative, isn't it, that we learn how this works? Jeremiah 17. The defense mechanism triggers whenever we're threatened, when your sense of values are threatened, when your self-worth is threatened. Then the defense mechanism, it's always there, and it will guard you, and it'll take over and provide a blind spot for you. It won't let you see yourself as doing evil. And that's why God says what he does here in Jeremiah. In Jeremiah 17, in verse 9, where God says this, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Yes, the mind is deceitful. That is, it will justify, it will rationalize. It will justify and rationalize in order to deny any wrongdoing. And it's not a deliberate thing. It actually will take place automatically. It's just a defense mechanism working unbridled, uncontrolled. But it means this. You and I can't really trust ourselves naturally. Unless we challenge ourselves, we won't see our true motives. And it's possible for us to do things for what we believe are the best of reasons. And we can do it having the worst motives. We won't see ourselves. We just won't, because the defense mechanism is there just doing its job. It's there to protect us and guard us from any pain. And so it won't let us see our own motives if we're going to have to see ourselves being wrong and feel that pain. But God sees beyond that, and he says in verse 10, I, the Lord, I search the hearts, I try the reins, even to give every man according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doing. Matthew 15. So God looks objectively on our heart and our motives. But do we look objectively on our heart and our motives? No, we don't, because of the defense mechanism. But we've got to be able to do that, or our heart actually can deceive us. And this is why it says that the heart is deceitful and wicked. Who can know it? You and I can't know our own heart unless we can see it objectively, and we've got to use God's standards. If we respond from our human spirit, it's possible to do evil, and that's why Jesus says in Matthew 15 and verse 19, out of the heart proceeds evil thoughts and murders and adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, and blasphemies. See, the human heart isn't really an evil thing. It can be good, but it has this blind spot. The defense mechanism will allow you to do wrong, and it'll blind us and lead us to do evil and sin in the name of good. It can blind us to our real motives, prompt us to rationalize, prompt us to justify and deny. We'll do anything to preserve ourselves, anything to protect the self, even just to protect our image. And we'll do it at all costs if we permit it. And this is the defense mechanism, uncontrolled, and something we've got to control. And it has been working throughout all of human history. And man has over and over and over again done wickedness. And he has said that he had to do it because others forced him to. For example, as Europe was about to plunge into the abyss in 1914, Kaiser Wilhelm said this: "The responsibility for the disaster which is now threatening the whole civilized world will not be laid at my door." Well, how could he say that? Well, because of the defense mechanism. Remember the Soviets refused to apologize for shooting down the Korean airliner? Their reaction in all of this was, in all sincerity, "You made us do it. It was the Koreans' fault because they flew over their airspace." Germany said they were forced to go to war. They needed more living space. Japan, they had to attack the United States. Their oil was cut off. But over and over, you realize it goes all through the course of human history. People never do evil. They're forced to do it by others. And we feel we must do what we have to do because, after all, we're defending ourselves. I understand that this is not a small thing, not a recent thing. The whole Bible story is a parade of this very occurrence. You know, the first human being to sin was Eve, and I want you to think about it. What was it that enabled her to disobey God? What prompted her to take of that fruit? You know, when Satan approached her, he said this: "Has God said that you can't eat of all the fruit in the garden?" And you can imagine him likely saying this in a sarcastic way. You understand that there was a threat here, a veiled threat. And the threat was that Eve didn't have special status with God. She didn't have unrestricted access to the garden. God was withholding something from her. And so Satan, he was attacking her sense of how valued she was by God. And so he was able to undermine God's authority by this, to make Eve think that God was withholding from her. She didn't have special status. And so what happens? The defense mechanism triggers, and she then begins to react by distancing herself from God and then strikes back. That is, she strikes back by not trusting God anymore, and then she can justify taking the forbidden fruit. It's the right thing to do. Since God had withheld something from her, not told her the whole truth. Think about, let's go to Genesis 4, if you will, by the way. Think about Cain and offering. Here's Cain, and Cain's trying to do good. I mean, after all, he's just giving an offering to God. There's only one little problem. The problem was God didn't accept his offering, and his feelings were hurt, and he felt a sense of rejection. And so what happens? The protective button is pushed. Cain reacts, and God asks him, "Why are you angry?" God wanted him to think about this. You know, what motivated you to be angry? What caused this? And he wanted him to see that it was just a feeling that was set in motion. It was the defense mechanism. Cain hadn't lost anything. Not really. See, God knows what's in man. He knows what his tendencies are. And so he told him, he said, "Why are you angry?" And then he told him, he said, "Look, sin is lying at the door." That is, Cain, you're just about ready to sin. Because sin and the defense mechanism are linked together so many times. You know, think about it. Cain could have just felt bad. "Hey, I tried to do the right thing, but I didn't do it well enough. Well, I'm going to try to do better next time." He could have done that, and then eventually his offering would have been accepted. Instead, he rose up in anger, retaliated for his loss, and kills his brother. And he did it because of what his brother had done to him. Because in his mind, Abel caused the loss and his acceptance before God in his eyes. Then after that, Lamech is in the game. He retaliates for his loss, and he's proud of it, see? He kills a man because the man had wounded him, Joseph's brothers, threatened by the father's seemingly approval of him and his superiority in the family. And so it is that their position seemed threatened to them. Jacob favored him. Their reaction, defend at all costs. Kill or get rid of him. And David, he didn't want Uriah to know what he had done. He really couldn't let himself face what he had done. And so he had to protect himself, get rid of the evidence, kill Uriah. The prophets of the Old Testament were rejected often and many times killed. And why? Because their preaching was a threat to the constituted authority. Those in power had to keep the status quo. And so the only way to do that was shut up the prophet that was speaking. Can you imagine Herod the Great killing all of those babies? Killing all of those babies. What was the threat? In his mind, he had to do it because the throne was threatened. There was talk of another king. And the little fledgling church, when it was started, it began to grow so much and so fast. But the church became a threat to all that the man named Saul believed in and all he had worked for all his life. And he had to do what he had to do to protect what he believed in. And so he began to wreak havoc in the church. Think for a minute. In his mind, Satan was justified in his war with God. Look how he had served faithfully and so long. And now the unthinkable, God was going to use puny human beings, and eventually they would be higher than he was. Something had to be done. Attack. In history, it's been one great big long parade of blood and destruction, all in the name of protecting the self. It's unbridled self-defense. My question today for us is this. Are any of us marching in this parade? Is our life a long parade of defensive behavior? Because if it is, it's likely that we have been hurting others and hurting ourselves. I remember watching this happen to one man in our congregation many, many years ago at a place far away from here. Vic was a very powerful man. He was a deacon in God's church, a leader, and he was in charge of the sound equipment. Vic had put his best friends on the crew, and he kind of was the leader of the group there, and he devised a kind of little kingdom of his own there, and he kept these people to himself pretty much, and they fellowshiped together, and all these people looked to him. He had four, five, six people on his crew there, more than he needed. And Vic always had the last word there, and they looked up to him. Well, one day, the pastor of that congregation was moved, and a new pastor came in and took over, and he saw this little fiefdom, if you'll let me call it that, that Vic had going in the congregation. And so he moved Vic to the parking lot where I was serving. It was a lateral move, but Vic didn't see it that way. Vic's reaction was he saw it as a demotion. He had no one he could control anymore to the same degree. And so while we were out there in the parking lot serving, he began to get sarcastic, and he would belittle and sometimes ridicule us for trying to do a good job out there. And eventually he stopped even coming out to the parking lot. And in time, he got even more bitter. You see, in his mind, the minister was taking something away from him that was his. And so he began to try to turn the friends of his against the minister. He began to badmouth everything that this minister did. And he began to cause division. And finally, he stopped coming to services altogether. He eventually left God and left God's way of life. And he did this all because of what he was losing, what was stripped away from him, being in charge of the sound system in a little congregation in Nowheresville, America. Terrible. But he didn't see that he was doing anything wrong. He didn't see that he was using this little group to build his own ego. He, in his mind, was terribly persecuted. To him, he was doing the right thing, and the minister was at fault. But I tell you today, this defense mechanism works in families as well. How many times are we just defending ourselves at home? When we don't get what we expected or hoped to get from our relationship, when that hope is threatened, do we strike out in anger? I remember another example from another congregation a few years back where there was a couple and the husband wasn't making enough money to pay the bills, and the wife was unhappy with this, and she began to complain and nag, and then sometimes she'd strike out with angry words. And the man, in his case, did not fight back. But he did something else. He began to start drinking heavily. And it was his means to me of fleeing, that he would avoid this. But I also think, as the relationship began to degenerate, that it may have been like passive-aggressive or something. I think this man was also drinking as a way to get back, because he knew how worried his wife was about this, and to see and how much she needed him to be strong and how much she needed him to be a man and to sacrifice for the family. And when he began to do this, it was him, in a way, getting back at her. And so it ended in divorce and tragedy. But you understand the point I make. This thing goes on in families over and over again. So many times, in one way or another, the defense mechanism is going on. Have you ever had this happen to you? You get your feelings hurt by something that is said, and then you feel like saying a cutting remark back. It happens over and over, doesn't it? And mates who start out loving each other end up in war. They never intended it to be like this. It just starts with, I'm not getting what I want, and so I defend myself, and I either speak out, bark back, or nag, or attack in one way or another. And these things happen over and over in life, don't they? You remember Tanya Harding? Nancy Kerrigan was a terrible threat to her. The answer? Break her leg. It happened to the man who struck Denny with the bricks. The society was against him, and it was hurting him, and he struck out in anger. It was the only way he knew how to do it. But it happens, too, with us in different degrees. It happens with our children when we don't get our way. It happens at work on the job when someone else does better, somebody else gets the promotion. It happens with close friends if they don't return our love. Let's go to Romans 12. The defense mechanism is behind this in so many cases, over and over. It's unbridled. But we've got to bridle this thing. Jesus controlled it, and we need to control it. We've got to do the same. In Romans 12, we're told how to do this. In verse 14, it says this, that we're to bless those that persecute you. Bless and curse not. Rejoice with them that do rejoice, and weep with them that weep. Be of the same mind towards one another. Don't mind high things, but instead condescend to men of low estate. Don't be wise in your own conceits, and recompense no man evil for evil. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. Let's go over to Matthew 16. And so there it is. Here's the command. Don't respond with evil for evil. Don't think we're that important, and it does take deep humility to return good for evil. But we've got to come to the point where we're willing to lose. We've got to be able to lose our lives. And this really is the real victory. And here in Matthew 16, in verse 24, then said Jesus unto his disciples, if any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, and whoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. Yes, we've got to come to the point where we're able to deny that self. Christ was tempted in this way. He overcame. He overcame this most powerful drive, and we too have got to face it and overcome it. He was tested in this way, and we're tested in this way. Let's go back to Hebrews 4, where we were before. Now, here's why I bring this up. He was tested in all points like we are, but I want to read another aspect of that verse just a little bit before it. Here's why. The defense mechanism can work in you and me, even as converted Christians. And it can cause us to resist God. We can resist and turn against Him by defending ourselves. You see, what God is doing with you and me is He's cutting little pieces of us away. He prunes us. And I'm reminded of a sculpture I saw years ago in a bookstore. And in the bookstore, it had a statue of a man, and it was like part rock, and part of the man was chiseled out of the rock, and it said, you know, to be patient with me, God isn't finished with me yet. And what God is making us to be, we aren't yet. And God is like an artist chiseling out a beautiful sculpture. He's chiseling out of what we are, the material we're made of. He's chiseling out beautiful human beings, children of God, sons and daughters. But in so doing, He's got to chisel away or cut away little pieces of us. And that can be painful at times. And what happens when He begins to cut away the dross? In Hebrews 4 and verse 12, it says this, "For the word of God is quick, and it's powerful, and it's sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing asunder of soul and spirit, and of the joints and marrow, and it's a discerner of the thoughts and the intents of the heart." Yes, there's times where you can read the scriptures and they just cut to the quick. They nail us. And you know what happens? It hurts. And if we're not careful, the defense mechanism will work to shield us from the painful pricks of the conscience that comes from God's word. It'll cause us to rationalize and justify and avoid the truth, because the truth can be painful. And then the defense mechanism is there to defend us from pain. And it can cause us to resist God's correction. I want you to think about it. When a person is an alcoholic or a drug addict, the biggest problem is getting the individual to see it. Denial is the biggest powerful force in their lives, because the mind will deny that we're in trouble. It will deny that there's sin involved in our lives. And it all happens naturally when God prunes us. And He cuts away the dead parts and the corrupt parts. It's a painful process. And we can, and some do, react to protect ourselves when He does this. And we get into some sort of tirade and begin to experience loss when we resist. And it may be God pruning us, and we act to protect ourselves from loss. Will we do anything to get out of a trial sometimes? You understand, we're in a trial and we react defensively and we begin to fight against God, and God may correct us with circumstances, and we're His children and He has every right to protect us. I mean, to punish us or spank us, correct us. How do we respond when God corrects us? Do we patiently wait to see what God is doing, or do we begin to resist Him? Do we get angry? Because some do. They get bitter by the experiences. It is the most foundational part of a human nature. We want pleasure in life, and we seek pleasure, and we seek to avoid the pain. We'll avoid any sense of loss or pain in life. And when we're denied something we want, or when we suffer loss, we get angry or bitter. It's all natural. It's all carnal. But let's look at Matthew 5 in this regard. It's just natural, but it is what we've got to overcome, the natural, so that we can become spiritual. Matthew 5 and verse 39, "I say unto you, that don't resist the evil," or don't resist harm, actually, "but whoever shall smite you on the right cheek, turn to him the other. If any man will sue you at law and take away your coat, let him have your cloak also. And whosoever shall compel you to go a mile, go with him too. Give to him that asks you, and from him that would borrow of you, turn not away. You've heard that it has been said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, and bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you. Pray for them that despitefully use you, and even those that persecute you. Why? Why be like this? It says this, that you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven, because he makes the sun to rise on the evil and the good. For if you love them that love you, what reward have you? Don't even the publicans do the same? What do you more? Do you not even the publicans so? He says, be you perfect, even as your Father, which is in heaven, is perfect. So this is an element. A person who can control this need to protect and provide for the self, that can deny the self and give to their enemies or to others, that person is becoming perfect. And God wants us to come to this place. He came to this place. He was willing to lose for the truth. And he was willing to lose for others. And he was willing to give up his life for you and for me. Now, you know, David was a man after God's own heart, the Bible says. But he doesn't mean that he didn't have the defense mechanism. He did have it, just like you and I. And his heart deceived him, too, sometimes. And so here he was, threatened by Saul, and he didn't respond and do any harm to him. But later, he lost that spiritual edge. And now he's willing to kill Uriah. And it's the only thing that God said he did wrong. He said only in the matter of Uriah, 2 Samuel 12. Later, we see that David, after he sinned, was confronted by Nathan. And God tells him the punishment that he's going to have to experience for what he did. But look at, in 2 Samuel 12, his response. Usually men will deny. I mean, it's just typical. They'll rationalize and they'll justify. But it's interesting how David's attitude wasn't like that, isn't it? David faced the sin and accepted the punishment. 2 Samuel 12, verse 13. And Nathan had told him what he had done, and he said unto Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said unto David, the Lord has put away your sin. You won't die. But David has developed the heart of Christ. When confronted by Nathan, he didn't rationalize things or justify himself. He didn't defend himself, but he trusted God and took the punishment God was going to give. Later, in another case, when he was attacked by his son Absalom, he was fleeing. And when he did this, he was fleeing, his old enemy began to throw rocks at him. And Abishai wanted to go take off the man's head, but David had been humbled by life's experience now. And he now realized that God was working with him and that he didn't need to defend himself. So 2 Samuel 16. In 2 Samuel 16, David said to Abishai and to all his servants, behold, my son, which came forth of my bowels, seeks my life. How much more now this Benjamite? Let him alone and let him curse me. For the Lord has bidden him. It may be that the Lord will look on my affliction and that the Lord will requite me good for his cursing this day. Can you see David coming full circle? Here he was a bloody man, quick to avenge, and then later in the Psalms, he looks only to God to avenge himself. He trusts in God. David at this point had come to rule over his own defense mechanism. And in that sense, he had become perfect, as Jesus had said later in Matthew. He could return good for evil and trust God to protect and defend him. Go to 1 Peter, 1 Peter 2, if you will. He, like Christ, had faced the defense mechanism. He had conquered it, ruled over it, and faced with great loss. Jesus said, thy will be done. This we must do too. And so it says in 1 Peter 2 and verse 18, therefore, servants, be subject to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the froward. And so today, servants can be our employees, that is. It could be a wife to a husband, or a husband to a boss. It could be young people towards their parents. It could be a local person assisting the ministry. It could be anyone, you and me. We can apply this to ourselves in every case. And then it says in verse 19, for this is thankworthy if a man for conscience toward God endures grief, suffering wrongfully. For what glory is it when you're buffeted for your faults if you take it patiently? But if when you do well and suffer for it and you take it patiently, this is acceptable to God. Why? Because you're overcoming a tremendous, powerful force in your life that can be dangerous and evil. Now, this isn't to say that we should be wanting to be masochists. We don't want abuse. We don't look for it. We don't want it. And so God says if they persecute you, you have the right to flee somewhere else, flee to another city. So we can flee situations that are threatening or resulting in loss. But we can only do that when it's within God's will. There may be a time when you and I cannot flee being hurt, and it's going to be the right thing to do. But to me, the main thing is this, is when we suffer some sort of loss at another's hand, that we don't strike back. We don't retaliate in kind. We don't take revenge because God says vengeance is mine. We can rule over this defense mechanism. When we do, God is pleased. We've learned a great lesson in life, and we're exercising faith. We're learning to be like Christ. Continuing in verse 21, for even hereunto were you called, because Christ suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow in his steps, who did no sin, and neither was guile found in his mouth, who when he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but he committed himself to him that judges righteously, who his own self bare our sins in his own body on the tree, that we being dead to sin should live to righteousness. And then it says, by whose stripes you and I were healed. So Christ suffered for us, and he was an example for us to follow. And we then need to be willing to suffer for him. We don't necessarily have to give up our physical lives now, but we are in little ways able to sacrifice pieces of ourselves and of our lives with the relationships we have with one another. And it means not fighting sometimes our mates to get our way. 1 Peter 3. Likewise, you wives, it says, be in subjection to your own husbands, that if any obey not the word, they also may without the word be won by the conduct of their wives, while they behold your chaste conversation coupled with fear or respect, whose adorning, let it not be the outward adorning of plaiting of hair or wearing of gold or putting on of apparel, but let it instead be the hidden person of the heart in that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God great price. And so it means the husband then must sacrifice his wants for their wife's needs. In 1 Peter 3, in verse 7 says, likewise you husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered. It means that every one of us do good to those who might have the ability to hurt us. In verse 8 it says, finally, be you all of one mind, having compassion one of another. Love his brethren. Be pitiful. Be courteous. Not rendering evil for evil or railing for railing, but contrary, blessing, knowing that this is why you're called, that you should inherit a blessing. And so we need to realize this. No one can harm us unless it is God's will. And if God allows someone to harm us, it's okay, isn't it? If he allows it, it's okay. We don't have to fight. Verse 13. Who is it that will harm you if you be followers of that which is good? But and if you suffer for righteousness' sake, happy are you. And be not afraid of their terror, and don't be troubled. So the point is, you and I don't have to react with inordinate fear. We don't have to get all uptight and try to defend ourselves. We can, and we should, rule over this thing called the defense mechanism and rule over it by doing what is good instead. If we do return good for evil, you know what will happen? We won't be angry. We won't get bitter. We'll have a decent conscience instead. Continuing on 1 Peter 3 and verse 16. having a good conscience that whereas they speak evil of you as evildoers, they may be ashamed that falsely accuse your good conversation or conduct in Christ. For it is better, if the will of God be so, that you suffer for well-doing than for evil-doing. For Christ also has once suffered for sins, the just or the unjust, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but quickened in the spirit. And so you and I are to follow that example in 1 Peter 4 and verse 1. For as much then as Christ has suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves with the same mind. For he that has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. So Jesus Christ, it says, learned obedience by the things he suffered. And we also learn by suffering and yet doing right. And we learn we don't have to fight back. We don't have to save ourselves. And if we learn this, we will prevent so much sin. We won't go on the tack to protect ourselves, and we won't hurt others. And as it says, we will cease from sin. And as we live this Christian life, there are times, there just are, times that we are going to suffer loss. We need to be willing to do that without striking back. And a final verse in chapter 4, in verse 19. Therefore, let them who suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to him in well-doing as unto a faithful Creator. Jesus overcame the overwhelming drive of self-preservation. He ruled over the defense mechanism, and he resisted unto blood. And he committed himself completely to God the Father. He agonized terribly as he realized what it would cost. But we need to be able to follow that sterling example, to be willing to lay down our lives for others, to not strike back, to not retaliate. And this, God says, is what it's like to become perfect. So let's strive to overcome the defense mechanism, and let's strive to render good for evil. Overcome the pride of this thing called the defense mechanism, and thereby cease from sin.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you found the message beneficial. If you would like to know more about the Eternal Church of God, we would like to hear from you. You may contact us at 1-800-723-6108. We also invite you to visit our website at eternalcog.org. Once again, thanks for listening.